Welcome to Brothers in Song, the podcast where we strive, whenever we can, to bring the motherfucking ruckus. How are things with you, Joe?
I'm ready to rock and roll, bro. Let's do this.
You're ready to have a ruckus. Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah. Perfect. So, how have things been in your life?
Pretty good. I'm in my office right now, and since it's the weekend, it's a little bit of a change of pace because we've been having some renovations done right above my office because I thought it was courteous for my dog sitter if I was going to ask them to stay here now with one dog. Well, with two dogs as opposed to one dog, I should upgrade my primary bathroom. So that ruckus has been happening for the last 5 weeks, but yeah. We're nearing completion and it turned out great. So that's been an interesting experience. How are you doing?
Pretty good. A lot of different little things going on, but big one is my kid is getting ready to visit some colleges in another month or so, which I'm still trying to wrap my head around, but it's an exciting time, and I'm interested to see where this path is going to lead him. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of interested to see, like, what is college like now? I have no idea. Besides really, really, really expensive, but... all right, I think it's time we get into this the meaty part of this episode. And to lead us into that, I've got a little question for you.
Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, we all know your passion is classical music and opera, so I'm not exactly sure how you're going to answer this, but what is the wildest concert or live event that you've been to?
Well, I have a couple. Very different, though. So I'll give you the most raucous one was I had the distinct privilege of living in Italy during the 2006 World Cup. So I went to several live screenings of World Cup matches of Italy versus somebody. Yeah. With tens of thousands of people. Not to put too fine a point on it, but I was in Milan and we were watching, like, I think it was like the quarterfinal, and they won pretty easily, and we were in the Piazza del Duomo in Milan, and there's probably, I don't know, I'm like 20,000 people is probably a conservative estimate. Just standing there screaming at a screen. And then we met some Sicilian guys and we were like, let's go grab some beer. And then he put like a bunch of beer in my backpack and he's like, let's just leave. It's fine. and just stole a bunch of beer from this like local convenience store guy.
Whoa,
but
he didn't have an international incident.
Yeah, no, for real. But that was definitely a wild night. And then like a couple weeks later, we were in a town, a very small town near the French border, and again watching a game with, you know, a couple thousand people, and these French people had this brilliant idea to come on over and try to antagonize the Italian fans. And the French crowd, it was probably like 25 people, went crazy because there was a penalty early in the game, and then you know, France is ahead, and they start antagonizing the locals. And long story short, the Carabinieri came over, the state police, and they're like, bro, there's 5,000 people here. If they decide to try to do something, we can't stop them. So you all better leave. And they left promptly afterwards.
Okay.
So that was pretty wild. And then I guess just harkening back to my classical roots, I was fortunate enough to be working at the Met when we had the 50th anniversary at Lincoln Center, and there was this huge gala and huge concert. It was probably four and a half hours long. I don't know, probably 3 hours in, the legendary baritone Dmitri Vorostovsky came out, and he had been battling brain cancer and had not sung at the Met in probably 18 months. And for a classical music crowd to stand, do a standing ovation for 3 minutes before the guy even opens his mouth was pretty wild.
Oh, wow.
And he sang great, and it was a great night. And, you know, he ended up passing away not too long after that. And so it was kind of cool that I got to be there to see, you know, classical music aficionados get a little wild for one night. So
yeah, that sounds like quite a send off. You know, we all have to go sometime, and I suppose that's as good a way to go as any.
Yeah. So I on the music front, I'm sure you've gone to some more wild concerts than I have. So do you have any?
Well, yes, and it has to do with the subject at hand.
Okay.
So in the mid-90s, I want to say this was around 1997, Rage Against the Machine and Wu-Tang Clan embarked on a tour together.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
And it had, like, it was kind of a big deal. Zach De La Rocha from Rage Against the Machine and RZA from Wu-Tang Clan were on the cover of Rolling Stone and stuff. So around this time, I think, is when, like, these sort of mid-level cities started building these amphitheaters for concerts, like these outdoor or like partially outdoor concert venues where you have like a lawn, like a hill, a big hill, and then it leads down into like the, you know, kind of open amphitheater space with seats. And the one in Hartford, Connecticut, which is known as the Meadows at the time, that had just opened up like a few years earlier. So Wu-Tang Clan went on first, and that was fine. And even though, you know, the music is kind of related, at the time it was definitely more more compartmentalized or siloed, the fan bases. Like, the Wu-Tang Clan people were there for Wu-Tang Clan, and then they left, and then the Rage Against the Machine people didn't really sit down until Rage Against the Machine came on. Mm-hmm. Well, during the Rage Against the Machine set, I don't know how this happened, but, like, we're on the lawn, you know, the big hill with all the grass, and they just said, like, I don't know, rolled out some sod like a couple days earlier or something. So like the grass had like no established like root system or anything. So people are just like ripping up the sod, throwing it all over the place. There was a fence. People tore down the fence. People set part of the fence on fire. Yeah, I don't know what was going on. I don't know how it all got started. But then, like, when security tackled somebody 2 feet away from where me and my friends were, we were like, I think it's time to go. It's just time to go. So that was like one of the more like precarious situations I had been in. But it's kind of funny because I went to that concert with Wu-Tang Clan, and I'd like heard a song or two. Like, I think one of the people I went with was a Wu-Tang person, but I don't really remember anything about their set or like know that much about their music, you know, kind of in general. So I thought this would be a fun topic to bring to the podcast.
I'm probably in a similar boat with you, where I certainly knew of Wu-Tang. I knew some of the members, but it wasn't something I was familiar with really at all. And so let me just put out this very broad disclaimer before we get into the actual content. It's like, folks, you will see my ignorance for this genre very early and often in this podcast.
Fair enough. I mean, I'm kind of in a similar boat. If there's anyone else out there who's, you know, not familiar with the Wu-Tang Clan, we'll try to help you out a little bit. And let's start with a little background. So Wu-Tang Clan, they're a hip-hop group from Staten Island, New York. The group was formed in 1992. And it consisted of 9 original members. 9. Mm-hmm. That would be RZA, the kind of de facto leader, GZA, Inspecta Deck, U-God, Raekwon, Ghostface Killah, Master Killah, and perhaps most famously, Method Man and Old Dirty Bastard. They had a very distinctive style, spearheaded by RZA, who served as the group's producer on most of the tracks. He used a variety of sped up and slowed down musical samples, and he also created a lot of the piano parts himself and drew a lot of inspiration from kung fu movies and sampled dialogue from like 25 to 30 kung fu movies by his estimation. So quite an interesting mix and a lot of personalities going into this, and it's kind of amazing that they made it all work together. So what we're going to get into with the Wu-Tang Clan is their first release, which is called Enter the Wu-Tang, parentheses, 36 Chambers. And I'm very interested, Joe, to hear what your first impressions are.
So here's the thing, is I knew of Method Man, I knew of Old Dirty Bastard, and I kind of knew of RZA. But, like, I definitely never listened to this very closely at all. And it's one of those things where it was happening while I was growing up. And it's not like I ignored it intentionally. I just, like, never really got around to it. But, I don't know. It was an interesting time just because of... And I think, like... Let me just take a step back. I think your story at the beginning really helped sort of crystallize it in my mind. Like, there were, like, very distinct, like, factions of genres, and, like, it was not common for things to cross over or to there to be anything like that. And, you know, with something like this, I'm just like, wow, I didn't know that this kind of thing was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's pretty cool. And one of the, like, key takeaways I had, because it took me a little bit to kind of get through this, was with so many members, it's like, oh, there's something new on every track because, you know, everybody's kind of doing their part, and that's great. And it's not like just the standard... pop album or rock and roll or some of the other genres where we talked about, where it's just like everybody plays on every track and they have a sound and it's the collective sound and the sum is greater than the parts, and that's all great and good. But like, this is like very much like, it's your turn, it's my turn, I'll work with you on this, but then these guys are going to go over here and do that. And to have it all kind of come together in a way that's pretty cohesive, I don't know, I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah, and you make a good point about the musical factions. And I think part of the reason is the way that music was consumed at the time. Because first of all, this stuff is like not radio ready. Like, not only because of the language, but also because I think it's like
people
are a little too weird.
Ready for that.
Yeah. Just a little too weird. And it's not like you can just try out a song, like just, you know, check something out on Apple Music or Spotify or whatever. And try out a song or two. You got to buy the whole thing, or you got to have, you know, friends who listen to it, who record some stuff for you and then share it with you. But then again, if we're all separated into these different kind of factions of music fans, maybe you don't have friends who listen to it. So the other funny thing is that I feel like the name Wu-Tang Clan is very famous.
Mm-hmm.
But how many people just walking down the street could name a Wu-Tang Clan song? Like, I think a lot of people would know who they are, but like not be able to name a song. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yep.
But as far as the album itself, I mean, and you kind of alluded to it earlier, is that the album feels kind of like a collage to me. Mm-hmm. Like there's the Kung Fu movie samples that weave in and out, and you know, you, like you said, you don't get everyone's voice on every song, so it seems like each member has maybe one or two songs where they're the main focus. So you just never know what you're going to get track to track. So that keeps things unpredictable, which is good. And as far as the aesthetic of the album itself, I really like how it's kind of gritty and kind of lo-fi, and there's a lot of like sort of muffled crackling sounds, like nothing is really all that crisp sounding. Mm-hmm. And it also, like the way it's produced, it doesn't feel like, you know, sort of in the mixing and mastering process that there's a lot of effort to, you know, make things a uniform volume or smooth things out or anything like that. But I think that works in this case. And, you know, a lot of the lyricism is very impressive. And, so it was a very interesting listen. What are some tracks that stood out to you?
Well, I mean, you can't really get past the opening track without it like smacking you in the face.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
So, which, like, in the best possible way, right? And then, I mean, the Wu-Tang Seventh Chamber, I really like that one. I know it's a little bit long, but it still was like really cool to me. And it was kind of cool that it had this sort of postlude at the end of the album. The thing that kind of stood out to me, like the overall sound, I do feel like it is mesmerizing in its own way. And you kind of get lost in the tracks and they just kind of click on through, and you're not like there's not like an abrupt end and then the next one starts and it's totally like it all kind of flows together, which I think is a credit to like the way that they constructed this. But like that was like an underlining sentiment that I had like throughout the whole thing. And so even with that, like those two tracks for sure stood out for me. What about for you? What were the key ones that you really liked?
Well, I definitely liked the two that you mentioned. I mean, Bring the Ruckus, the opening track. That's I think I'm gonna have to put that on a playlist somewhere because gets you so hyped, you know?
Yeah.
And then the second track, whose full title I will not say, Shame on a Person.
Yeah.
It has such a cool horn sample and like a dusty piano thing happening, and Old Dirty Bastard is the one who's featured most on that, and his voice is just very singular, and
it's a one, it's of just, one, as I like to say.
He is a one of one.
You know it immediately.
So even though I don't listen to all that much contemporary hip hop, I'll listen to things here and there. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a coolness that everyone tries to adopt, like that they're kind of above everything or something like that. And not really emoting, like they're too busy just trying to be cool and like kind of above it all.
Cool, tough. Yeah.
And not really like show much in the way of emotion or dynamics. And all these guys, but especially Old Dirty Bastard, is like the complete antithesis of that. He's like, I'm going to be as weird as I want to be. I'm going to make like weird sounds and say crazy shit. And he sounds like he's having fun. Like, like some of the stuff you hear, like, Ice Spice doesn't sound like she's having any fun, for example.
Yeah.
Like, I just, like, that's one, I don't know, she's somebody I for whatever reason, I've come across a lot in the mm-hmm. past few months. And she's just like, I'm trying to be cool. You know? You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's just very, like, manicured. But, so, like, and especially on that song, he's being himself to the fullest. I also really like Clan in the Front and The Mystery of Chess Boxing mm-hmm. because they just have like such cool sounds. Like Clan in the Front has this very cool like dissonant piano loop that's kind of jazzy. Jizza's got some great verses on that. And The Mystery of Chess Boxing, the loop on that kind of sounds like a harpsichord. I don't know what they're doing to make that, if it's a sample or if somebody played it. There are these kind of spoken, kind of sung backing vocals, which are just like, I don't know that I've ever heard anybody do that before. And it's mm-hmm. kind of like an anchor of the song, because you just have a few voices in the background going, ooh, ah, ooh, ah. And it's yeah. like, and it's like, what is that? But it makes sense. And you know, there's a lot of great verses on that song as well. You know, and I actually thought about like jotting down some of the lyrics and like mm-hmm. pointing out which ones, but then I thought better of myself.
and then your list is going to be like as long as your arm, then, if you do it that way.
True. Yeah. Yeah. But just trust us and like listen to the songs and like follow along with the lyrics. It's like really clever turns of phrase in a lot of this stuff.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, and they certainly don't get credit for this, but like Wu-Tang and other really prolific rappers of this era don't get the credit that they deserve as being essentially modern day poets. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you took some of what they said, especially you know, some of the lived experiences expressed in on this album, certainly in Wu-Tang Forever, their following album. It's like, if that wasn't set to like R&B rhythms and music, would people pay attention to it in a different way? And I don't know the answer to that, but I know that there was like certainly a sentiment when it was coming out that it was like for a certain type of person or a certain like demographic. And obviously like that is part of it, but that doesn't mean that people who, you know, like as I'm going through it every day now, like, you know, that doesn't mean that people who aren't of that couldn't appreciate it for being great art. And I feel like that's why, to your earlier point where it's like, well, people know who Wu-Tang Clan is, but they couldn't actually tell you like anything about them. And I would put myself in that own category before we listened to this album together. That's something was absolutely true for me. And maybe they should get a little bit more credit for being the artist that they are. Because I don't always think that comes through, just because people are not familiar with the way that they're presenting their stories that they're trying to tell.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you. And in regard to like the poetry and lyricism aspect of it, I think a lot of people just like can't get back past the cursing and like some of the mm-hmm. the slang and stuff like that. And you know, I think that's largely to do with prejudice and possibly racism. Mm-hmm. And
for sure.
And in a broader sense, I've been thinking a lot about language lately, and mm-hmm. just I've kind of made this shift in my brain from being like prescriptive about language and like how there's a certain way you have to say things or do things. But the point of language is communication. And
yeah,
if it communicates, then it works, you know. Then it, if it communicates, then it is correct. And just because someone is saying something in a different way than you does not rob that thing that they're saying of its validity and its basic truth, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking about that a lot in general, and I think that the way that they say things might be a barrier to a lot of people, white people, mm-hmm. and I don't know, you know, I don't know how to move past that. But when you look at like all the metaphors and wordplay that's going on, it's really sophisticated.
Oh yeah, without a doubt, it's super smart. And again, you do have to take a closer listen to it. And it took me a while to get ready for this episode, because what would happen to me is that I would put it on with the intention of listening to it, but that was not the only thing I was doing. And then, you know, I would get my own way. I'd be starting to think about something else, and then it would just feel like a little bit like background music or something like that. And, you know, I had to restart it several times because that was happening to me, where I was just like, oh, I'm not like actually paying attention. And it's not because it's not good. It's just because it's mesmerizing in a good way. But you do have to pay attention. And that's true for a lot of music, especially like classical music as well, where it's one of those things where you can get lost in the loop. And then the loop just kind of continues and it's there. And I guess that's kind of an endearing quality of this music too, because you can kind of just have it on if you know it really well and like really, really find the still identify the spots that really you enjoy the most and like stop what you're doing and like pay attention to it. That happened to me more than once in this album, where it's just like, oh, I totally just got lost. And then like three tracks later, I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's just kind of a trap that people fall into in general. And it's interesting how the way that people listen to music has evolved, because mm-hmm. before music was portable, you kind of had to intentionally
sit there,
put on music
it, yeah.
and listen to yeah, it. Yeah. Like I suppose you could put on a record and like do other stuff, mm-hmm. but you had to be in the presence of whatever it is you wanted to listen to.
A device of some nature that wasn't just able to fold up into your pocket.
And, you know, I do a lot of listening to music in my car. I do a lot of listening to music when I'm out for a walk. And sometimes that really works for me. And I did notice a lot of the qualities that we're talking about here while I was listening to the music walking around or what have you.
Sure. Yeah.
But then when I sat down to make my notes and I wanted to have things fresh in my mind, I sat there and I listened to it intentionally without doing anything. And I mm-hmm. noticed more stuff. Like
yeah.
that,
yeah.
Like that harpsichord sound in The Mystery of Chess Box, and like I hadn't really noticed that before, or like I heard it, but then when I was just intentionally listening to it, I'm like, oh, this has a really interesting quality that I didn't notice before.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, and like this is again my ignorance probably showing, but like I feel like just because of when this was made, they probably were on the cutting edge of like incorporating, you know, strings or harpsichord or like other types of classical music into their beats and their loops that they were using to rap over. I could be wrong, but that definitely seems like a new approach that they added to the genre that I don't think was very prevalent before. This album, certainly subsequent albums that they had.
Right. Well, the sampling of stuff has always been a part of hip hop.
Yeah.
But I was reading a little something about this, trying to get some additional information, and the way that this article talked about the way that RZA would use samples is that he was using them to kind of paint with instead of just like, you know, copying them whole cloth just so they could rap over the samples. And when he was laying down piano tracks and stuff, he was inspired by people like Thelonious Monk, who I've been thinking about talking about on this show for a little while now. And that makes a lot of sense when you hear some of the like dissonant jazzy piano that goes on in this, album.
No, I could totally see that for sure.
Now, was there anything on this album that you feel like didn't work as well as some of the stuff we've just mentioned?
I mean, I'm so new to all this. I'm not going to say like it didn't work, but maybe I just need to spend a little more time with it. Probably Protect Your Neck. Was one that I probably need to listen to a little bit more. And then the second to last one, Tears. I feel like there's more there, and I just haven't spent enough time with it for my own mind to kind of make sense of it. So like, those were two that I was kind of like, I don't quite get it yet, and maybe maybe I never will, or maybe it's not for me. But it's also could be a very strong possibility that I just need to listen to them a little bit more. What about you? Were there any that stood out for you that were a little less than optimum? I'll say that. Phrase it that way.
There's a very long intro to the song Method Man.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off by, you know, it's this conversation between Method Man and I'm not sure who the other person in this little sketch is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ostensibly the two of them are high and they're talking about various ridiculous ways to torture people. And it's like, it's the kind of bullshit you might say to your friends in middle school, like when you're trying to like outgross each other.
Sure.
And things like that. And I think it's supposed to be humorous, you know, and
I guess it is.
And look, it's not my favorite, but I don't want to be a hypocrite, you know, like the kind of like violence and like gross out imagery of these like torture scenes that they're describing.
Mm-hmm.
I was just kind of like, oh, I don't know if I like that. But then, like, if I really sit down and think about it, it's like, I watch plenty of violent movies and, like, you know, there's some violence in other music that I listen to and, you know, in other media. So, you know, it is what it is. I feel like it didn't really fit in, like, the overall aesthetic of the album. You know, I feel like all the interludes from the Kung Fu movies, those were like a common thread being woven through there, and like the sketch just seemed to come out of nowhere. And the fact that you can't listen to this otherwise like pretty cool song without getting through however long that little sketch is, 90 seconds or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was one specific thing that didn't really work for me.
Well, I don't know a lot about hip hop, but if there's one thing I know less about, it's probably Kung Fu movies.
Yeah.
So that kind of went over, like, I get what they were trying to do, but it totally went over my head. And again, that's totally fine. Just like, I don't know what the hell's going on with all that.
You know, and maybe we need to get together one night and just like pick one of the Kung Fu movies and just see what the big deal is. Like, I was like, I had intended on watching, I'll be honest, I had intended on watching like one of the Kung Fu movies just to get a feel for it, and it just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I also tried to find out like why Kung Fu movies, but I couldn't really come up with anything except they seem to like Kung Fu movies. So. Yeah,
somebody got obsessed with them at some point, and
like, yeah, that and was they their just thing. Like, let's put it in the album. And like, I think it's a pretty cool thread through the album. Like, the audio's not that great. Like, who knows how they were, you know, getting the actual sound to put on the album. So it like sounds kind of crappy, but like, it's good that it sounds crappy. Like, I don't know.
Okay.
It's just another one of their idiosyncrasies. So I like it, even though I don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any final thoughts on this one?
So I think you touched on it a little bit with your last comment in that they do have a lot of idiosyncrasies. And I guess that's going to happen anytime you put like 9 creative people together and tell them to like create something. But like, maybe that is part of the reason why they weren't quite as popular or as ubiquitous as some of the other stars of this genre that were their contemporaries, like Tupac or like Biggie Smalls or, you know, Warren G and people like that. And that's fine. But I do think like there's a lot of merit to this album and certainly subsequent albums. Like Wu-Tang Forever, I feel like is like a masterpiece, and that doesn't happen unless they have the ability and the time to create this. Mm-hmm. And you can see like the legacy of that now. I mean, we're recording this at the end of March. Beyonce just released this like huge epic, like I don't even know what you would call it, but because I'm not keeping up with the times, but that was even one where it's like, oh, I'm kind of curious. I'm going to like click through a couple of these tracks and when it came out, like the day it came out. And it's certainly different and certainly her own thing, but you can hear, and it's just probably because I was listening to this to get ready for this episode and I happened to be listening to that, but I'm like, oh, there's fingerprints all over this thing. Of like how you take different elements of stuff that's important to you, make it your own, but also like connect it to stuff that mm-hmm. already exists. And you know, that's a theme we've talked about a lot on this podcast, where art is iterative and everybody kind of borrows from everybody else and is inspired by other people. And you know, I think Wu-Tang, and it's a credit to their longevity, and they're still pretty, you know, pretty important place in pop culture and certainly in the hip hop world. You know, they're really an incredibly influential and talented group. And, you know, at least for people like you and me, maybe don't get the credit that they deserve
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
all the time, at least.
All of that definitely makes sense to me. And what's interesting about this, or another thing that's interesting about this, is that you don't seem to get rap groups anymore. Like, I remember there were times when there was rap groups, like there was NWA, mm-hmm. you know, Wu-Tang Clan, you know, several others, or even like rapper duos. You just don't get that anymore. I'm not exactly sure why. Maybe it's a marketing thing. I don't know. But the fact that not only was this a group, but it was a group of 9 guys.
Yeah.
And you know, the rapper Capadonna joined them later, like after the death of Old Dirty Bastard. But mm-hmm. it's the same guys throughout their whole history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really kind of remarkable, like, that they were able to find each other and stick with it and, like, come to some sort of a consensus about, like, how things should be on their albums. That's definitely no small feat.
Not at all. Yeah.
In any case, you know, the sonic experimentation that we've talked about, you know, their willingness to just be unabashedly themselves and be a little weird and not care about it. All of that makes them a really compelling group of artists. That's pretty much all I have to say about it.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it was a good pick by you. Definitely out of our comfort zone, but in the best possible way. So I'm glad that we got a chance to listen to this one together.
Yeah. So, Joe, I didn't ask you before we started recording. Do you know what your next pick is going to be?
I think I do. And you know, not to get too far behind the curtain, but we try to share some thoughts of things we have in mind for a couple episodes ahead of time. So it's not going to be like a complete shock to Dan, but I will break the suspense and tell you. How about we listen to the Stephen Sondheim classic Merrily We Roll Along, because it is on Broadway. And I learned recently that you have never listened to that. So I think I'm going to make you do it.
All right. That sounds good to me. I mean, I have a lot of respect and admiration for the recently departed Stephen Sondheim, but I don't know anything about this musical in particular, and we haven't really done any Broadway musical stuff on the show yet in all this time, so I think it's about time we do something about that.
That's right. Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you, friends, for joining us once again. And we'll see you on our next episode. Take care. Brothers in Song is written, created, and produced by Joseph Collin and Daniel Collin. Edited by Daniel Collin. Our theme music is by Iconograph. For the latest news, follow us on Instagram @Brothers in Song.